on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Yeah!
Well, well, well. Welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. However you've decided to spend this hour with us, we're really, really, really glad to have you. One of the big things that are going on worldwide today, it is World AIDS Day. And with that, there's all sorts of talk. You can take a look at the Vancouver Sun. There's been so many articles today. But I really want to find out what's going on our home front. And one of the organizations that does work 365 days a year in our own backyard is here in the house. So I've got YouthCo, and with YouthCo, I've got their development and communications, Mr. Michael Reed. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, I know it's been a really busy day for you. You've been doing a lot of stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of talk downtown at a lot of the medical establishments about mm-hmm. World AIDS Day. But at YouthCo, we try to take it to a more community level and to work with youth and meet them where they are. Mm-hmm. So today we had our event called Groundswell that was going on at Storium
nice.
Downtown. And that showcases our theater troupe, which uses a form of theater called Forum Theater. And they use that to address issues that you wouldn't usually be able to talk about. They use acting and mm-hmm. Creating scenes with the audience in order to address difficult issues like disclosing HIV status or stigma around getting tested mm-hmm. and it creates a safe space where people can talk about those issues. And then I also was here at UBC tonight. I was over at the Marine Drive residence.
Nice.
And the Friends of Doctors Without Borders, which I guess is a campus organization, they were throwing a coffee house, which was just, it was amazing. It was well attended. There was about 50 people, and they had talks from us at YouthCo, but also from some people who were living with HIV, who had lived through the actual AIDS epidemic here mm-hmm. in Canada, and how that had affected their lives. And it was a great night, and now I'm here.
Well, I'm really excited that you're here, and I know your day's been a long one, and thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about YouthCo. What is the mission?
The mission of YouthCo is to engage with youth aged 15 to 29
okay.
About HIV and hepatitis C, and really try to educate them, first of all, about the risks in terms of sexual activity and transmission of these diseases. But we also really focus on the social aspects of the disease and how stigma and psychological issues and relationship issues and self-esteem issues and issues around your sexual orientation mm-hmm. or your cultural background, whether there's a history of oppression, and how that can affect your confidence as a sexual being and how that can put you at risk for illness.
And I'm really glad that you're doing that work. That's absolutely imperative. How long has YouthCo been around?
YouthCo was founded officially in 1994, but mm-hmm. the work was going on before then. And that was pretty much at the height of the AIDS epidemic. It was a group of positive youth in Vancouver who just, they didn't see the services there for them, and they didn't see anyone really paying attention to their needs. And so they broke away and created a very grassroots organization in their living room, and it was all volunteer to begin with, providing mm-hmm. support services to youth. And it was really one of the first youth-driven health issue organizations in Canada, and there was a lot of... there's a lot of stigma around youth itself
mm-hmm.
and how, what they have to say doesn't matter and how, it should be left up to other people. But, these were people facing a life or death illness at the time, and they decided that they wanted to do what was best for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they started this organization that's totally peer-driven, and it's we're going strong 16 years later now.
I think that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's definitely grown from somebody's living room to where it is now. So paint me a picture of what it's like now.
YouthCo is one of the main AIDS service organizations in Vancouver. We do service a specific population, and it's over the years, the the government, the medical establishment, other organizations have really come to respect our point of view and our opinion, and can see that youth voice is very necessary at the table, especially when the diseases that we are trying to, we're trying to decrease the spread, mm-hmm. a lot of it is happening among young people.
Why do you think that is?
There's many issues. Mainly it has to do with a lack of education. A lot of sex ed has been not terribly effective.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of top-down messaging in public health. When you have authoritative governments, I'm not implying that the government is authoritarian, just telling people what to do in their sex lives, people don't internalize that. And the approach that we've taken is a peer-based approach, and that is people listen to people who are like them,
mm-hmm.
Whether that is the same cultural background or same age, same sexual orientation. That's been proven time and again, and is accepted by the mm-hmm. establishment that is the way to go. And that's why we have a lot of specific organizations such as Positive Women's Network,
mm-hmm.
and Healing Our Spirit for Aboriginals. And so that's kind of the direction we've been going in now.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fantastic. And I love the fact that you're using theater, using improv, and I think it's wonderful because I remember back in the days of Green Thumb Theater when they used to do the "My body's nobody's body but mine. You run your own body, let me run. And sorry, StatsCan, or not StatsCan, SoCan. Yeah. Sorry, everybody who's listening out there. Obviously, you can tell this is a talk show, not a music show. But in regards to that, just that theater is really, really great just to get people talking about things. So what are some of the things you'd mention in regards to stigma? That's been a huge thing, and it still is a big thing that you'd mentioned in our pre-show chat, that when you go into the schools to do the HIV education, that's one of the things that comes up in regards to stigma. If someone has HIV, what are some of the things that you give as an example as how to have that "I have" conversation?
A good place to start would be at the talk I was at tonight with the Doctors Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about AIDS in Africa, Asia, and same disease, but mm-hmm. because it has so many social factors to
mm-hmm.
it, it looks totally different here. And a lot of the time we kind of push it off of ourselves, and it's easy to other the disease and say that it's happening over there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, that's happening to the people on television, and it's to be fair, what's happening there is noticeably different. In a place like Vancouver, where we have free access to treatment in BC for mm-hmm. HIV, and also just a higher standard of living, and just better health determinants overall, HIV has become a chronic, manageable illness. You hear people saying it's not the death sentence it used to be. That's a cliche that we try not to say anymore. That's
mm-hmm.
it's not productive to imply death in that sort of thing. But
it is
a chronic, manageable illness. If you are accessing treatment and if you are accessing the social supports that you need to stay healthy,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stigma is around people we see as having HIV because they're not healthy. So around intravenous drug use, quote-unquote promiscuous sex, that sort of thing. There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of there's still a lot of stigma around those issues.
And you'd mentioned in our pre-show chat as well, just in terms of just trying to criminalize people who pass HIV on to others who were not positive before.
Mm-hmm.
And just what's USCO's stance on that?
Well, telling someone you have HIV or telling a partner
mm-hmm.
is called disclosing. And disclosing can be a very tough thing to do for a lot of people. Many people, because of the way, especially young people right now who are in their 20s, who were born and remember some of the early AIDS epidemic,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of that, the media exposure and a lot of the attitudes are ingrained into their heads still, and it's very difficult they have feelings of guilt and sometimes as if, you know, feelings like they're toxic, like they can never have sex ever again, like no one's ever going to love them. Mm-hmm. And again, this can be very hard when it's you've been told by a doctor that you're sick, but you don't feel sick necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so it's a deep psychological battle, and disclosing is obviously very important for prevention, preventing the spread of HIV, yeah, like you said, there is a movement right now. Well, not a movement. There was a court case from the Supreme Court of Canada about a decade ago, basically stating that if someone puts their partner at a reasonable risk of contracting HIV, then they can be subject to criminal penalty and be charged with aggravated sexual assault. This obviously creates a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. They never really defined what significant risk means. It's been applied across the country very unevenly. Because it's in the common law, so it's being dealt with by lower courts.
Okay.
And so slowly there's a precedent developing across the whole country, but it's putting people who do have HIV feeling like they're being persecuted, and also like it's causing anxiety because they just don't know how it's going to turn out. It's mm-hmm. the law is unclear.
Give me an example of from one extreme to the other how the law is interpreted, and as an example, just things that you've heard.
Right. So yeah, last week we actually did a day-long workshop with the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network.
Okay.
And I'm not a lawyer, and I can't remember the specifics, but there was a certain case in a province where someone did use a condom, and they were found guilty of this alleged crime, and then in another province, someone didn't use a condom, and they were found not guilty. And obviously, there's a lot of variables that went into that. It's a mm-hmm. whole court case. There's obviously details I'm leaving out, but those are the basic facts. And it was it's just, you know, when that's happening, it's hard to know what to expect.
Mm-hmm. And it must be confusing as well because it's as you mentioned, it definitely causes anxiety because people don't know what's right, what's wrong. And especially if you've disclosed to someone and you are using a condom, and sometimes condoms break. They're not 100%, you know, protection.
Yeah. Just moving in this direction towards, mm-hmm. first of all, there's no other illness that's really criminalized in any sort of way. You have public health issue diseases like tuberculosis where, you know, you can be ordered into a hospital for treatment, but you're not charged criminally. So mm-hmm. that it kind of shows in itself the stigma and negative association with this particular illness.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since, you know, it is a manageable chronic disease now that mm-hmm. Saying that it's aggravated assault when compared to other illnesses is just totally inconsistent.
So what are you advising for people who do have HIV or AIDS? Because as you mentioned, there's a lot of anxiety. So I imagine with anxiety, by getting people to talk about it, there's probably some concerns that come up. And what are some of the things that seem to be helping?
For, you know, on an individual basis, for positive people in their daily lives,
mm-hmm.
It is wise at this point to disclose whenever possible, whatever they feel that it is appropriate,
mm-hmm.
and to just always. I mean, we do say that everyone should always be using condoms and reducing risk as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just where the problem comes in, because this is putting the responsibility for safe sex on a single person. Whereas over the last 15 years, all prevention and you know, kind of anything that's been put in place to stop the spread of HIV that has worked and has been proven to work,
mm-hmm.
Has been based on mutual responsibility, and to use the criminal system, which by its very nature persecutes individuals, to use that for public health mm-hmm. is problematic.
So what do you see as the solution?
Well, The one thing that would make it more clear would be to have a law on the books about it. However, that's not really what advocates for positive people are going for.
Mm.
First of all, that won't give any leeway for personal situations. And also, we probably don't want to see what kind of law conservative government would put on the books for this. So we're not, and by we, I mean the HIV advocate community and specifically the legal network, and I'm not speaking for them, but they are recommending what they're calling prosecutorial guidelines,
mm-hmm.
which will be developed for prosecutors so that there can be a little bit more consistency about who they choose to prosecute, because really it's in their control who
mm-hmm.
they take to court on this issue. So that's where things are going right now. It's still in process. The other issue is science, and really if the law is about transmitting this illness, then mm-hmm. you have to understand the science behind that transmission. And so there's a big push to educate police officers and prosecutors and judges. The Legal Network did a workshop for a few dozen judges in the last few months,
mm-hmm.
And just educating them about the actual science behind HIV and where it is now versus before, and why there might be some confusion as to, you know, when someone has a zero viral load and someone's using a condom, how there is no significant risk. There is an insignificant risk.
I think it's really neat that you're getting involved and spreading these words. It's so important, and getting these conversations, because I think the more people talk about things, I think the more it doesn't freak them out as much.
Yeah, and also it's just people, you know, walking down the street in their regular lives, don't think about these things, and mm-hmm. it's not their fault. It's just not on their radar. It's not in their daily lives. But they just have to realize that it is in the daily lives of lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And people who have this illness have to deal with this whole other layer of problems in their life. And I mean, emotionally, and you know, in terms of relationships, having to disclose status is hard mm-hmm. enough. And you know, the feeling that you know, in what's supposed to be a romantic situation, then having to do that. I mean, there's lots of issues at play.
There's a lot of issues, but at the same time, it's one of those things that I think it needs to be discussed. I know for example, herpes, or as well, with HPV, for example, just letting people know is I strongly advise as well, which with HPV, it always I always have to remind people that just because you've had the vaccine for it, that only protects against a few strands, the
right.
most key ones, but even still, it's still possible that you might have it.
Yes.
And because there's hundreds of them, it's really difficult to actually
yes. and we,
track.
If someone can disclose all the time and
mm-hmm.
be perfectly honest and confident in that, then they should do it. And you know, they should want to be with someone who wants them for them. And it's perfectly, it's within the realm of science, and it's within, it's possible to have a relationship where one person has HIV and the other one doesn't. If
mm-hmm.
if the person who is positive is on medication and they're using protection, there's almost no chance of transmission. So, you know, in the long run, it is good to disclose. However, what we try to tell people is there are so many factors that play into whether someone is able or even, you know, understands the consequences of what disclosing is. I mean, women, for instance, tend not to disclose sometimes because of fear of violence from their lover, and you know, there's just all these issues
mm-hmm.
going on. A lot of people don't know their status. That's becoming an increasingly large problem.
Really,
and testing.
I was just going to ask, how often
yeah.
should be people getting tested? Should it be once a year on your birthday? Like, I know for women, I always endorse, like with pap tests, I say go for a full physical.
Right.
It's your birthday gift to yourself to check where you're at, even if it's not the results that you want to hear. Like, say you've got high cholesterol or whatever it is, at least that way you can take a look and you can take stock, and it's like, okay, how do I move forward so I can live a life of wellness and take care of myself the best I can?
Exactly. And yeah, we don't want to diminish HIV because it is a serious illness.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you use too many scare tactics, people are just going to, they're not going to actively not get tested because, you know, they're not thinking that like, oh, well, if I just don't know, I can do whatever I want.
Mm.
People will go into denial about things and they just won't get tested because the consequences outweigh not knowing, right? So.
And do you think that's partly because we are very conservative? I can't say that word because I struggle over that. A very conservative country in a lot of ways, where I do believe in a lot of ways that our education in terms of sexuality in general is very abstinence-based, even though there have been so many studies, but by educating people, they tend to make wiser decisions. They usually tend to have a higher sense of self-esteem, so it's not tied in as much.
Yep.
And what are your thoughts in regards to that?
That's something that we do on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Is most of our work, or our work that reaches the most number of people, are our sexual health workshops and sexual self-esteem workshops, specifically to what you were talking to before. And it's just teaching, you know, young teens mostly.
Young teens? Do you mean tweens or teens?
I mean the Bieber crowd at the moment, I guess.
who are
now very sexually aware,
mm-hmm.
but they're aware, but they're not educated, and there's a huge difference there.
Paint me a picture of, so say I am a tween/teen and you're coming into my classroom to educate me. What are some of the five top things that come up?
Right. First we try to get a sense of what people know already.
Okay.
And it also helps us, so we do a brainstorm, we throw it out to the class, and depending on the age, you'll get some ridiculous things, but that just shows, you know, what they know about the issue.
And of course I have to ask this question, give me an example of the most ridiculous thing.
Oh, I haven't done one in a while with younger kids, so I really couldn't tell you. I'd have to, but we do have one. One of our educators, Ainsley, she does this every single day, and she'll just come back to the office like laughing her head off about just. And it's not that it's the children are ridiculous. It's just naive.
And what the thoughts are out there,
yeah.
Because they're not getting the education necessarily at home, because not all families are comfortable or may not know what to talk and how to
mm-hmm.
bring that up. Those conversations.
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting you bring that up. Because family background and the personal situation, whether, you know, a religious situation or socioeconomic
mm-hmm.
or just the living situation, really affects what people learn and what
mm-hmm.
they will absorb from various outlets. And then, you know, in situations where self-esteem of the child is not necessarily promoted,
mm-hmm.
You know, you'll have a spiral of destructive behavior, which can lead to illness.
Mm-hmm. No, I can definitely see that.
Mm.
What other things go on in terms of the classroom? So you mentioned a lot of times it starts with the brainstorm and people come up with what they already know. And then from there, what else do you talk about?
We do focus on the science behind HIV, which is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep our resources up to date and educated on that. And we really stress that we're not experts, we're not scientists, we're educators.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things we don't know. We try not to use statistics too much in classrooms. We find it kind of children don't really, old children, but, you know, young adults and youth don't necessarily process what those mean in any sort of context, so they're
mm-hmm.
not necessarily helpful. They can be inflammatory at times if they, you know, kind of have a negative spin on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go into, after the science, we really try to explore the people's attitudes towards the illness and then just try to make a connection between the two and how, you know, the science doesn't really necessarily match the reactions that some people have over it.
I was going to ask you as well in regards to certain cultures, for example, like I've had a couple guests on the show that have spoken in regards to the South Asian community, and one was about hymenoplasty, where women were actually getting their hymens resurgically attached because of fear of being beaten, and this was actually happening, believe it or not, in White Rock, and so I was surprised it was happening in Vancouver, just outside of Vancouver, but as well as cause that, just even with HPV, with because there's PAP Awareness Week about a month and a half ago on the 25th of October. And just a lot of the South Asian community, there was a great group called White Orchid, which was trying to educate for a lot of the South Asian community, where they found a lot of times the women wouldn't go for testing because of the fact it was considered, it was just not something that was done.
Yeah, no, I mean, stigma around illness is universal in all in every culture, and it's not just, you know, the West that demonizes that sort of thing. It's I mean, you think of lepers, you think of tuberculosis in the 1800s, and you know, there's always, when people are scared of something that they can't see, they try to remove it, and that doesn't work because the illness is inside people, and so you end up hurting the people.
Based in terms of, though, that we do have, we're a multicultural facility, is there some educators who can speak different languages, like Chinese, for example, because Vancouver's got a really huge Chinese population, both Mandarin and Cantonese, as well as Punjabi, for example.
Yeah, there are other, again, we try to specialized organizations work better. So there are other, I believe it's called ASIA, it's an acronym. I believe that might work with Asian sex trade workers, but don't quote me on that. Anyways,
sure,
it's an
do.
Example of the one of the organizations. We do deal mainly in English. That's a very good point. Yeah, if you're going to be communicating with people, that's obviously one huge barrier to education.
But it's great at the same time if there's other organizations you can partner with, so that way you can refer them and just work with them. So then that way, if that happens, which I know you and I were chatting before the show as well, which I'm going to ask this question on air, in regards to, because Youth Co. works with youth, so 29 to about 15 years old, approximately, in term. And with that, what happens when they hit the big 3-0? Like, are they kicked to the street? No, you can't use my services anymore because you're 30, you're old.
No.
Okay. Or do you?
Basically, we counsel them and provide a kind of a plan to move on if they do still require services. People who still aren't having their basic needs met, if they're street involved or homeless, then there are other organizations that are amazing that they can move on to. If they are kind of living more of a stable life, there's BCPWA, the
Persons with AIDS Association.
Like I mentioned earlier, the Positive Women's Network. There's Dr. Peter Center for people who are maybe progressing farther with their illness. And so I mean, there's no shortage of amazing organizations in Vancouver, and we're really lucky. People don't realize, but I mean, we are on the forefront of a lot of social service work. You know, you think of Toronto as the financial capital of Canada, but Vancouver really is the capital of this sort of work, and there's a lot of good stuff going on. You can say it's because we have a lot of problems, but we're trying to address them, so that's the important thing.
And I think it's really, really good. If in the future for Youth Co., what would you like to see?
It's a good question, because we've been, the nature of Youth Co. is because, and just to reiterate, the organization is run entirely by people under 30 as well. And so just think of you in your 20s, how unstable your career was, how unstable you moving around was, you know, probably 7 apartments in 1 year, maybe. So we do have high turnover in staff. It's probably about 2 years for the longer ones, which is hard for continuity, for sure. But then it also creates an amazing opportunity to constantly have new ideas. And because we're young, we do have new ideas. And so we just completed a rebranding of the organization. We worked with a local younger oriented design firm called Lyft, and they helped us with our website and a new logo.
Nice.
And we're just kind of acknowledging our old logo used to be a rocket ship for many years.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, people have probably seen it around if you've been in Vancouver for any length of time. But, you know, we're just recognizing now that youth are much more media savvy. They're much more, they don't like being patronized. They don't like being treated like they're children, even if they are. and so, yeah, we've gone for a more classic, modern, those things are opposite, I guess, but that's, you know, that's designer speak, I guess. Classic, classic modern logo and a new website. And we're also, we didn't really mean for this to happen, but I think it's just because of the age group.
You've got your Generation Y as well.
Yeah, so we've got a huge social media presence, which just kind of happened. And that's been being recognized by other organizations, and we're being asked for our help on that. I'm going tomorrow to the BC Centre for Disease Control for a day-long workshop on their, they're going to start launching some new online sexual health programs. And again, they realize now, especially with technology changing so rapidly, that young people will just have a more, will have a better intuitive knowledge of that because they've grown up with it.
No, I think it's great. Technology has made things more accessible. I even know with BC Women's Hospital that does a lot of work with addiction, abuse as well, and mental health, and where they're able to get people to actually come in for that almost teleconference, which was really neat. I thought it was neat because of the fact you could actually see the person on the other line. It was like Skype all the way through where they... It was quite nice, and then people who weren't able to were able to download it afterwards, so that was nice. And as you and I were chatting about pre-show, it's just nice because Twitter's so immediate. Like as you're saying that there are certain things that you wanted for the show, and you're able to just send a tweet, and that person that you're trying to get a hold of was able to send the link to that presentation immediately.
Yeah, the Leon who was doing the workshop for the legal network. Yeah, I was coming in here. I'm like, oh, well, we're probably going to talk about criminalization. I just had my BlackBerry. I didn't have any of the materials with me. So, you know, I just tweeted to him in Toronto. I'm like, send me some, you know, resources. And it just happened. So, I mean, social media has, when used correctly, has huge potential for cooperation between organizations, which can become very insular sometimes. And especially geographically, to spread it out internationally. I just discovered the other day there's an organization exactly like YouthCo in rural Minnesota with all the same values, and they're on Twitter. And so, I mean, we've been talking and exchanging resources, and it's a great tool. And the implications for public health also are enormous because social media, by its nature, is peer driven. And you're getting information from your friends constantly, and recommendations from people that you know who are the same as you. And that, as we mentioned earlier, is the best way to get out sexual health messages. And so, and that's what we're working on. Is to harness that.
I think that's awesome. What is the biggest thing you've learned with social media?
You have to be selective in your use of the different platforms, such as Facebook, Twitter. There's this new one specifically for nonprofits, which was launched by one of the co-founders of Facebook.
Which one's that one?
It's called Jumo, I think, it links with Facebook, and you can people go on and basically follow their favorite causes or their favorite organizations. And it's basically just charity and cause focused.
Nice.
Yeah. The problems with social media, it hasn't really panned out much for fundraising. Still, it's good for friend raising, for getting people out for you and following your cause and everything. But in terms of directly targeting people for nonprofit fundraising in social media, it doesn't really work that well. Email is still far more effective, as well as obviously direct contact is the best. But that's something everyone had their eye on for social media for nonprofits, and it's not really that efficient. Yeah.
I think you've hit on the key, but I think it's about friend building, but the trick is to get to meet them offline. So getting them to come down to check out, see what you do, whether or not it's participating in teleconference, better yet, inviting them down to the facility, taking a peek, this is what we do, how would you like to get involved? Which on that note, say somebody who's 30 wants to get involved. Is that possible, and how can they get involved? Because they're not youth. They know your mandate is...
Yeah, they're... They can't, I mean, by law, by the constitution of our organization, board members must be under 30. Everything other than that is kind of a gray area. It's kind of accepted. I mean, we can't, by legal standards, you can't discriminate in an employment based on age, right?
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah. Oh, good. I beat you to it. So, however, people who work at YouthCo have come to respect the... what we do there, and and a lot of people feel old at YouthCo by the time they get to 30, and it's time for them to go.
Well, there's a lot of compassion burnout as well, just doing the kind of work that you're doing. So.
Yeah, and especially if, you know, you're going out there trying to be someone's peer, and you're 12 years older than them, you know, you're just not going to feel as effective, and there's never been a problem with that. And you know what, most people go on to amazing jobs from YouthCo. Like I said, we've been around for 16 years now, and it's really been a launching pad for a lot of people. We've started an alumni program now as something to re-engage with people who used to work and be involved here, and just the number of people who are in high positions in the medical field and in social services and in government, and they really went on to do really amazing things helping people.
I think that's really cool. And you, speaking of alumni, are UBC alumni, which I love. So how did you personally get involved with YouthCo? What made you decide was fit?
I did my degree in social geography, the Bachelor of Arts.
Okay.
And in the early 2000s. And I was coming from Toronto, and the geography department at UBC basically studies Vancouver because it's just such a neat place in terms of location and the different socioeconomic things that are going on here. And so it was really just, I didn't know anything about Vancouver till I got here, and then I ended up getting a degree in Vancouver, basically, and just studying the different subcultures of downtown. And I did a lot of my papers on gay men and how they moved around downtown during, like, where they lived in the 80s versus now, and how HIV affected, you know, maybe affected the number of nightclubs that were open, because there were so many downtown, and then it changed. So I've always been interested in the interaction between culture and disease and health, and so that was just an interest of mine. And then a very good friend of mine disclosed to me that he was HIV positive, and was involved at YouthCo, and I got involved because of that, and that was the first time that I'd known anyone, and I know this was just a couple of years ago when I was about 25, and as a young gay man, I hadn't actually met anyone who was young who was positive, because it is kept still so secret. And that just totally changed my point of view on it, and I just got involved, and I was on the board of directors at YouthCo for about a year, and then transitioned into a staff role, and that's how I got here.
I think that's awesome. What do you do as an organization? Because you've mentioned there's high turnover, which is great for evolution. What types of steps do you put so then that way, in terms of the succession planning, that somebody's not having to basically, is able to step into those footsteps and keep walking forward as opposed to going steps back?
Right. That's something that we didn't really have for years, and we do actually call it succession planning. That's so we've been doing that the last few years, and it's working out now. We just had a huge staff turnover, probably about 80% of the staff just happened to be leaving at the same time. But it was all planned for, and again, we're not doing this on purpose necessarily, but a lot of the people hired were somehow affiliated with the organization already, so there were some learnings there that they had about, so they could fill those roles more effectively. We did just hire a new executive director who was from a totally different organization. We hadn't even interacted with him before. And so, you know, it's nice to have the mix between, you know, you don't want to become too... Youthco has a very strong internal culture, and you, because of the values that we have, they're so unique. And
what are your values?
We have a few of them. Basically, to be youth-driven, to be anti-oppression. So just the ways that oppression can lead to illness because of you know, lack of self-worth and that sort of thing. So is another one of them. And being sex positive, you know, we don't go in saying don't have sex. We acknowledge that people have sex, and that to lots of people sex is different to each individual, what that means, and to celebrate all of that, but to do it in the most responsible way possible.
So what do you think is the best course of action in regards to people who do want to get involved? Because the government has been really concerned just in general in regards to a lot of things. Like, we've got polygamy, so they're trying to change a lot of the laws. There's been some questions raised in regards to abortion. Just in the last couple of years, there's been a lot. And in terms of the criminalization, in terms of sexuality, but as well as that, with sex trade as well, where there is whether to decriminalize or whether or not to legalize or abolition. So there's a lot in terms of sexuality where they're talking about. And I like to think of government should be about the people and what the people want, but sometimes I wonder, how do we change our society in terms of being apathetic, where we actually do go out and we get involved? So the government really is actually a democratic process, like it's meant to be.
Yeah, and what I've discovered since I've been working, especially being out in the community more, is, you know, the government is they're people, and they're people that who are making these decisions. When you go out and talk to, you know, public health officials, they want to understand. A lot of oppressive things and ignorant things happen because they're ignorant. They just don't know. And
and so that's where we need to educate them. In other words,
and that's where our organization comes in. And we're very strong. We have a very strong advocacy role in the community, and just, you know, going out and talking to people. You know, a lot of the times it can be frustrating. You don't feel like you're necessarily directly helping individuals. Like, we have a support program for positive youth who come in, and, you know, that's, you know, we're helping them personally, and that's very important. But then there's also the larger issue of, you know, trying to educate society and trying to decrease the stigma around all of these issues, and that can be frustrating, but it's something that has to continually happen, or else, because when you get complacent, people will forget.
One of the things I was going to ask, because you'd mentioned that you do a lot of education as well, just about stigma, and how to have that conversation sometimes with people that, hello, my name is, and I'm HIV positive. And with that, how do you recommend doing it? Because I know usually what I've recommended for, like, for some of our listeners, so say they have herpes or they have cervical cancer, for example, HPV. There are certain websites where sometimes it's nice we're not just having that conversation, but letting that partner who may or may not have it, just giving them so they can actually take a look and see, so they can actually get the facts, where it's like, here, this is the most recent information. Is there some resources on the YouthCo website for that?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, we just redid our website. It's very... we have all of our own information about HIV and Hep C, but there's lots of links through to other places. Yeah, again, we recognize that we're not experts, so we really like to rely on good, solid information that's coming from other sources. And like I said, there's a lot of happening at higher levels to fix this to engage with people and get them the information that they need. The CDC is going to be redoing their sexual health online presence, and it's
Send me a press release. I can tell them that tomorrow.
that's going to take a couple of years, but people are being more responsive to these issues.
So, if people want to get involved with YouthCo, how can they get involved?
There's lots of ways. We have a whole bunch of events that go on. We just had our big fundraiser called Brunch with Benefits.
I like that.
Yeah, it was it was at five restaurants, at a market at the Shangri-La, and then at Twisted Fork, Subi's, whole bunch of... We tried to use restaurants that make it accessible to everyone.
Yes.
Because we do serve lots of different populations who have different means, but they're all equally important to us. So we did that, and we're going to be spinning those off and having volunteers who want to organize brunch with their friends as a fundraiser. We'll provide the materials and negotiate with the restaurants about a charitable donation, and then they can do it that way. So that's kind of a brand new thing. But regularly we have a regular volunteer program where people can come in and get taught how to be facilitators and go out and do workshops.
Nice.
A lot of our workshops are done by volunteers who have gone through training. And then coming in and learning about us. We have a lot of education, really interesting education stuff that goes on. And like I said, just being an advocate in the community, and a lot of the people that volunteer for us just come in for our community nights, where we maybe watch a film or and then discuss the issues about it and try to get people thinking about things a little deeper, and then they'll go out and take that into their daily lives, and that's volunteering too.
No, I think that's great. And are people able to donate online at your website?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Your website?
www.youthco.org. And we have full online donations, and specifically we're raising money now for our Aboriginal Youth Project.
Okay, tell me about that.
It works. It's peer-driven by Aboriginal youth, and it works with Aboriginal groups in kind of an urban setting, but we also try to get out into rural communities where a lot of the time they're neglected by sexual health educators, and try to get to reserves and smaller communities. And it's an arts-based kind of project. So they use film. They work with the youth to make films and art to explore the issues around sexual illness and also the history of colonization and how that's affected the health of families. We talk about residential schools and how that really did destroy the health of an entire generation of Aboriginal people, and how that has trickled down and how that affects youth now. And they definitely have seen it in their lives. And again, that sort of oppression is a risk. It makes people vulnerable to disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty innovative project. And we're also launching a new gay men's outreach project. The CDC just released new stats for young gay men, and they're not terribly encouraging. A lot of positive men don't know that they're positive. Around 40% of them.
40%.
Yes, and that was taken from a sample of from downtown, from bars and stuff. So it wasn't a large sample. It was substantial, and it means something.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really shows that I think people have forgotten about young gay men. That was.
That was a long time ago. That was 20 years ago.
Other people have HIV now, and especially it's just obviously what's happening now isn't reaching young gay men, and that's our job as the youth organization. So, if innovative programs, and we'll always accept donations, and we love having new members of the youth community.
Which I like. I think it's really great. And how else can other people get involved? So obviously they can donate money. They can volunteer their time. Through social media, can they spread the word?
Yeah, definitely. We have a Facebook fan page with about 1,200 people now and growing, all local. So it's pretty amazing for to have that many people for a local organization. We're on Twitter. We're where we really engage with, you know, more of our community partners. You know, it is Twitter's, you know, a lot of professionals and that, but it's a good way to engage in discussions. And and I mean, a good example is today, World AIDS Day. There is a huge push by the United Nations AIDS Agency to have a social media campaign around it. And I mean, I might be mistaken, but it seems like at least online and also on television, World AIDS Day this year was quite heavily covered, and lots of people changing their, you know, Facebook pictures to the red ribbons. And so there's all this, there's this potential to be involved by just participating in that way.
I think that's awesome. If you could wave a magic wand and change things 10 years from now, what would you like to see in regards to YouthCo?
In regards to YouthCo, well, with YouthCo, it is like waving a magic wand every 10 years because it's constantly changing. And, you know, the next batch of young people who come in are going to be totally different and have a totally different outlook on things. And, you know, even, you know, I'm 27 now, and even people 5 years younger than me have a totally different take on life. And their exposure to media is even higher than mine. So I think change is going to continue to happen faster, but hopefully in a productive way.
I hope so, too. And I think that's one of the key things you're mentioning in terms of social media. It's great where people get involved, but I think it's a matter of continuing where you start with the friends that way and then getting them offline. It's like online dating where you start off, you know, people start following you. They follow your cause, and it's like, hey, come on, come down, check out what we do, and let's get involved. And because I think people have to buy in before they cash in sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And
for
it's,
sure.
It's important. So I applaud you guys for the work you're doing. So congratulations, and thank you so much for being on the show, because I know it's been a long day for you. So,
well, yeah, World AIDS Day is once a year, so.
Well, I've almost had you up until midnight doing work. I'm just spreading the word. So,
thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, actually, let's get you to plug your website one more time. It's youthco.org, isn't it?
Youthco.org, yep. And if you're interested in the brunch program I mentioned earlier, it's brunchwithbenefits.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Up next is Hans von Klaus's Misery Hour. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with. He'll be guiding you through the wee hours with his ambient music and his super hot voice. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. We will be back next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
With writing my